The society we know, our own culture, is based upon the exchange of women, wrote Lucy Rigari. That world in which women are commodities to be traded by men to further the economic model that is the family is what we call the patriarchy. And women and men are not born but become so through a slow process of repeating gestures of styling our bodies to be feminine, to be masculine. Where do we learn that? Through family, school, society, and by seeing ourselves, our ideal selves, in art. Theatre has a complex relationship to gender norms. On the one hand, it is the textbook of how to be a man, a woman, a husband, a wife, a family, a society. On the other hand, no art form is as open to subverting and questioning these norms more. On theatre stage, there is also drag, burlesque, performance art, voguing. The stage is where Nora slammed the door and walked out of her marriage. Queer is everything outside the norm of how to be a man or a woman. It is subversive, but never violent. Queer is a gay man whose t-shirt says dyke. Queer is a femme lesbian. Queer is a single mother. Queer is a man who cries. In the fourth season of Audio Stage, we talk to performers and performance makers about what queer is and isn't, how it exists in theatre, how queer theatre exists in the world, about its political power and its aesthetic urgency. I'm Jana Perković and with me today is Zvonimir Dobrović. Zvonimir is the artistic director of queer festivals in Croatia and in New York. And Perforations? Perforations is festival of performance?
Live art.
Live art. In ex-EU countries, is
yeah,
it?
It's focused on countries, the Balkan countries.
And Zvonimir founded his first festival at the age of 23?
Yes.
Which was queer festival in Zagreb?
Yeah.
And he has been very influential, I think, in defining so the parameters of queer art or queer performance, certainly in Croatia and in that part of Europe, and I think more widely as well. It's really a great pleasure to have him randomly visit Australia while I'm here. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, so before we start, I keep thinking about that, you know, Asterix?
Yeah.
So there is the volume called Asterix and Cleopatra, which opens up with a scene in Egypt with Cleopatra and the servant, and they're talking, and the speech balloons are in hieroglyphics for about half a page, and then there is a little asterisk, and it says, for the comfort of the viewers, we will continue with subtitles, and then they switch to normal language, and I sort of feel like that right now, because we, of course, could be talking in Croatian, but we're speaking in English.
Yes.
For the comfort of our viewers.
Or listeners.
Yes. 2003 in Croatia, this was the year I finished high school and promptly moved out. It's the year of the first gay pride, I think.
The second.
Or was it the second in Croatia? And also the year of the first queer festival.
Yeah.
So why 2003? Why is that? Why queer festival?
So I was 22 when I had the idea that I wanted to do a queer festival. And I grew up, obviously, in Croatia during the time when there was nothing queer. Or it was not even on radar of people, but it was on my radar because I wanted to meet other people. I wanted to, basically out of maybe even a selfish need, mm-hmm. to learn about myself and see in a way what's out there. I was involved with the arts, with producing other festivals.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, so you were already working at Eurocast, which at the time was the biggest festival of theatre. So how old were you when you started working?
17. So I was already working in this major theatre festival for several years. But then I had the idea that I would like to have my own festival, and obviously, yes, and obviously a festival that would have queer in the title, which was very important, I think, just to disable anybody to make it invisible if they want to. So whenever there is a review, they have to say it's a queer. So it was just a way to put the word out there. And the concept in a way out there, and the context of Croatia at the time, you know, it was a left government, the first one after independence.
It was the first one ever, basically.
Yeah. And the city of Zagreb had a leftist government as well, and actually a woman who is now the Minister of Culture was the kind of the Minister of Culture for the city. Mm. And 2003 was also a year that a few other festivals started. It was kind of a push, I would say, for almost liberalization of the arts, mm-hmm. In Zagreb at least. So that's the year that not only Queer Zagreb started, but also the Zagreb Film Festival and the World Theatre Festival, which is another big festival in Croatia for theatre. So these are the three major festivals, the two major and one small one, mm-hmm. That started in the same year and still continue to this day. And the two big festivals were actually kind of more pushed by the government with funding and everything. We were kind of the sidekick to the whole.
You got your concept through.
Yeah, we got the concept
the door
through.
Opened.
Yes, the door opened and we got it through. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I went there for a meeting to say I want to do this. The guy who was responsible for funding at that time, he said to me, "Can't you get a boyfriend without a festival?" And it never, you know, was my idea, but I have to say it helps to have a festival, to find boyfriends.
Only to you or to all of us?
Well, to me mostly, but I do the hard work on the festival. But I have helped, you know, there are people in Zagreb who are, who have been having very good sexual lives because of the festival, I'm thinking. No.
So just to explain the context a little bit, for the entirety of the 90s, Croatia had a war. It was a war for independence, yeah. ostensibly, and moved from a socialist system to a kind of wild capitalist system. Mm. And the dominant discourse, the kind of official discourse of the time, was extremely conservative and patriarchal, and it really promoted a sort of macho values, also because the war, I think, was so close. So yeah. this very, very basic... we have just defended our land with weapons. Values were really, really strongly promoted. And this is actually not very different from Australia today. Also, not to be, not to have an inferiority complex there. Because in Australia, again, we see this sort of resurgence of patriarchal, macho values, very kind of nationalism and militarism. But Croatia was also full of guns. I mean, the reason why I left Croatia at the time was that I felt that there was absolutely no kind of possibility to really introduce something like the queer discourse, like to liberalize the way people were talking about each other and about what's right and what's wrong. Yeah. And what made you think that that was the time?
But for me, it was the time. The time is never right. It will never be the time. It will not happen by itself. So you... have to create the situation. So that was for me. So for me, the time was right, and I created it in a way, in the circumstances that were there. So what I wanted to say also about the 90s and about the war, I think what happens when there is a war or great danger to a state, of course, critical thinking goes out the window. The popular feelings become very, very much based on fear, and when you have fear in the public sphere, you can do anything with people. You can manipulate because it plays with the basic emotions of safety. And this is what nationalism and conservatism always does. So they always play with fear, and it's always fear of the other. And anything can be that other and that threat. In Croatia at the time, it was another nationality, another ethnicity. But in today's society, in peaceful societies, you know, peaceful in hyphen, is the fear of the immigrants, the fear of other sexualities, the fear of anything that's not dominant in one context or one place. So in that situation, then, unfortunately, in Croatia, having had the burden of socialism and communism, and people wildly wanted to get rid of that and had these romanticized ideas of what the future could be or what the alternative was. Unfortunately, along with nationalism came very strong religious influence, which was nationalist. And it's often that in countries that had a socialist communist past, the church becomes the nationalist element. While in countries that had a fascist dictatorship, like Brazil or Spain, the church is more revolutionary. So that's it was an unfortunate thing in Croatia. But within that, it was very important, while introducing queer, to try to move it away from the traditional discourse, and that was through the triad, you know, through medicine, legislation, and religion, like it was an illness, a crime, or a sin. So it was always bad. You would always read about yourself or about anything non-heterosexual through those prisms.
So after some years, you produced a really beautiful book, which is titled The Oral History of Homosexuality in Croatia, I think, which I have just been reading.
Oh.
I obtained it. And a really beautiful thing about that book is that it has a lot of reproductions of newspaper articles from the 90s about homosexuality, which I all remember. I've all read them at the time. And the language is very interesting, because the titles and the subtitles of these articles are often something like, research estimates there are 20 to 30,000 homosexuals in Zagreb alone. Who are they? What do they do?
Yeah. What it's very sensationalist, I have to say. But it's, on the other hand, I think the media played a very strong and very big part in changing the discourse in the public. So today, I find it would be really ridiculous for politicians to use the language that they did 10 years ago. The public discourse has changed, not necessarily the feelings, but at least the discourse has. And it's just not acceptable anymore, as it was before, to dismiss somebody based on sexual identity. However, there was this referendum for marriage, and during that campaign, some of the discourse came back. And that was actually very frightening to see. And it just reminded you that this education, constant education about acceptance and tolerance of other, can't be forgotten. You have to do it with every generation. It should be in schools from the earliest age.
I felt for a long time that diversity in gender and sexuality in Croatia, in a place like Croatia, which is southeastern European, is an extremely inflammatory topic, because it attacks the primacy of man within family. People do react in an extremely violent way. I wanted to mention the Eurocas, the festival you're working for, in 1997. Eurocas was always a very provocative festival, and also by chance was the biggest theater festival in Croatia, so it played this very strange role in the 90s of being quite well funded and at the same time hated. And it had an edition in 1997, which was on body art. And it almost got shut down, I think, that year. It brought Annie Sprinkle, it brought
Franco B, Orlan, Ron Athey, and Stellark from Australia.
There was a couple of HIV-positive artists at a time where really no one talked about AIDS in Croatia. At a time where there was no one openly gay, really, in the media. And there was at least one theater critic, I think, who said that the artists invited were more suited to a psychiatry textbook than to a book of theater history. I find it just very interesting that, you know, the first thing that happens is that there's a left-wing government. The first thing you do is go, let's go with queer. Queer is actually the most important thing to put in here. We may all get violently, beaten up and tortured. Why? Because I really felt at the time that there was nothing to be done.
That's what they want you to do. They want you to feel powerless. And I think once you feel powerless, you are powerless. Somehow. Mm. It sounds now romantic to say it like that. But it's you are never powerless. And actually, the stage, those some square meters, are the most powerful square meters in the world. The stage, nothing else. It's really strange. It's something I truly believe. And it's Queer Zagreb was really, it was a gut reaction to something. Mm-hmm. But why people want to act violently, and it's not only, I think, in Croatia, homosexuality, especially male homosexuality in this traditional way of looking at it, of course it undermines the position of a man, or there is this research that this Macedonian author, I forgot the name now, but he, when there was kind of a trouble between Albania and Macedonia, or Albanians in Macedonia, there was, he said that people would accept homosexuality between the two nations, but they said, okay, if you have to sleep, if you have to, if I can say it like this, fuck with an Albanian, don't be a bottom. So that was at least, you know, at least you're a man still. So this whole notion of, you know, gender binarism and, you know, what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman, that's what is undermined somehow. And that's what's subversive in the minds of heteronormativity, I would think. And that's what scares people somehow. And I'm often surprised how people are always graphic in their heads when they think about homosexuality. They always think about, sounds silly, but they always think about anal sex. They have questions, how you do, you know, it's really strange. Yeah, it's something that I don't wonder when I meet people, how is it actually that
how do you have sex?
How do you have sex? How, I guess it's okay, but it just proves that you need to teach people in school that there are different sexualities.
Well, but it comes from the word itself, because if the word is homosexual, it's really defining you by the sexual.
Yeah. Your but sexual it's behavior. Also heterosexual. You have it there as well. So, and we are sexual people. I think it's, we should be, you know, sex positive in all areas, and people should have more sex in general. But just to say about this violence, there is really a strange violent reaction to homosexuals. Or at that time, it was the the only way people knew how to deal with it would be through violence, and that's something that doesn't change. It can still happen to you anywhere. You can go to London and get beaten up. In New York, there's been trouble last year. You know, people have been killed. This happens, and it's not fine, of course, but it's a reality. You can get beaten up because you speak a different language or a different skin color. That does not matter in that sense. But what matters is, and what was scary and what had to change, was how the system deals with that. So if you get beaten up because you're a homosexual in Croatia, and you go to the police, and then you get ridiculed there, and nothing is being done, then that's even a bigger crime. Because that's a crime of the system towards you. And then you feel no protection, and then others are even more encouraged to be violent or to commit crime against you, knowing that nothing will happen. And that's a way of silencing a whole community. So to fight that, you have to be public and out and outspoken about everything. But then you have to actually conquer some inner fear that something could happen to you. And I never had any problems personally, but I know that my parents were maybe more worried than I was. So for them, it was, I guess, a more stressful time than for me.
Do you think that 10 years or now 11, 12 years of Queer Festival changed things? And this is not a naive question, because I'm very interested in does art change society? How do we know? How do we measure? How do we assess that? Because we all act as if art does change the world.
I think it does. I think art changes people, and that then changes the world in a way, because we are the world. I mean, it changes people. I mean, art is transformative. It has been for me. I know everybody has been transformed by art, even people who are not aware of that. Otherwise, it would be a very dry existence. You would go to work, do something that's completely not connected with you, and come home and do what? People read, you watch movies, you see sculptures around, you see everything is art. Art defines everything around us and inside us. So art does change. And what art, queer art, what the Queer Festival managed to do, I think, was to give people an identification or something to identify with, or to, not a role model, but to not always to have to reimagine a situation. Because I remember for myself, it was very important to see movies with gay characters. That was important. It was important to see Derek Jarman films. It was important to watch, to read books that were not only straight books, because I went through high school only once mentioning homosexuality, and it was in class, a language class of Croatian, when we were talking about the French symbolists, and it was Rimbaud and Verlaine and all this kind of thing, but it was, you know, it was kind of a additional side note, and you know, we never talked about all the other artists who were queer, who were gay, or who challenged sexuality, and let alone about even women writers or feminist writers. So that kind of normativity actually brings out intolerance and homophobia. So homophobia is almost a natural state after the education system is done with you. So to change that, you have to use art, you have to, because it's culturally learned, obviously, the homophobia, so you have to culturally unlearn it somehow. And I know now, I mean, I was within the festival, so I was kind of in the eye of the
storm,
so I don't have that kind of thing. But I know people come to me and say, you know, this festival helped me in a time when I, you know, didn't know what to do. And I know for myself also how these, somebody who organized these movies screenings in the 90s, that helped me also. The right to culture is it's almost a human right. it's a basic thing. And I think now there is a lot of queer art, and it's everywhere, and it's almost too popular, or everybody wants to do it, or everybody wants to be a part of it, and that's I think great.
Let's talk about the word queer. You define queer very nicely as queer being everything outside the norm, subversive but never violent.
Yeah.
And the first queer festival, and this I really remember, you said single mothers are queer, and that was a very nice framing of the term as fundamentally not in the norm. And I always think that it's a much more useful concept for teenagers, for example, because, you know, as a teenager, you don't really know who you are in any sense. You don't know who you are emotionally, who you are psychologically, what you want to be when you grow up. And it's very hard to pick your sexual category immediately. And I would really like to see the notion of queer introduced to young people, because I think it liberates you, actually.
Yeah, because you don't have to choose, almost. But I think it was important for us to introduce the word queer, because it was unknown outside of a very, you know, academia or a small circle. For what we wanted to do, to have it mainstream and to do this festival, to talk to a lot of people, we needed to make a new definition. Or introduce a definition, but for me also a definition that's more contemporary, or that was more relevant than what queer became or where it was at the time. So we tried to go even beyond this traditional reading of queer, and to really stretch it completely. And in that, I thought it had more power, because it was always about this, you know, strange or fluidity or something, but some academics were also complaining about it, because they said if you stretch it too much, it loses all meaning, so then you can put anything there. And I disagreed with that. I thought it doesn't have to always be connected with sexuality or gender, because I think when we talk about this margin and what's norm and what's outside of the norm, you can be outside of the norm on many different levels, not always on levels of sexuality or gender.
So you would include ethnic difference?
Yeah. This is how we did it. The first book that we have now published more than 30 books, or, you know, translations or books that we did or edited. But the first one was queer stories, short stories, a book of short stories. And we had a call for writers or whoever to send in stories, to try to redefine, to try to see how they see queer. And a lot of, this is what got me thinking, got me going in that direction. A lot of the stories had no connection to sexuality, had no sex in them. They were talking about the church, about families, about all kinds of stuff that people felt could be queer or is outside of the norm. of whatever the norm in Croatia at the time is. And then I realized, okay, the norm is always geographical. So something that's the norm in Croatia might not be the norm in Germany or in another continent. But the norms that divide people or puts them, you know, in a good spot or a bad spot or a spot of judgment don't have to be in connection with sexuality or gender. Mm-hmm. So it can be, you know, economic things. It can be race. It can be education. All of those things define somehow your position on the social map, and that all is legitimately queer, I think.
I really like that you bring the geographical aspect to queer, because I think that the spatial perspective is often lost in social sciences and humanities. But so if queer is defined as being opposed to the... If you would define it as being outside of the norm, and if norm is geographically specific, then can there be such a thing as an international queer community?
Yes, of course, because there is one, you know.
But ostensibly something that's queer in place A would not be queer at all in place B.
Yeah, but maybe some common denominator of being queer wherever you are connects you to, you know, makes that connection somehow.
Quite practically in your work, which is right, making a festival of international performance in a specific place, how do you negotiate that question of something that I've seen in Brazil is queer there, but if I bring it to another place, it won't be.
But you don't lose it. It's not like suddenly you lose meaning if you bring a piece somewhere else. For example, in Brazil, there is an artist who did this piece called A Dance of the Crazy Creole. So it was about his black skin in Brazil. So there's a lot of racial issues in Brazil because race is then connected to, you know, poverty, crime, different social status, whatever. And he was playing in that piece with his ethnicity, with the nationalism of Brazil. So, you know, doing all kinds of stuff with the flag and then queering it up a little bit, dressing up in it as well. So playing also with the ideas of masculinity and the ideas of femininity of his male body. So that in Brazil had a specific thing. A Croatian artist would not do that piece because he has different, or she will have different issues. They would not deal, they would deal with nationalism, but maybe wouldn't include all the other things.
Maybe they'll have the same issues, but completely different reference points.
Of course, but it would work both ways, because when he performed in Croatia, people read, okay, he's coming from one perspective, what is, you know, what puts him in a certain situation in his country, and people could relate. Because nationalism is universal, so you can relate, everybody deals with it in some way or the other. And then you could put yourself, okay, my issue with the system is not through my skin, but it may be through my social status or my
accent.
Economic or accent or whatever. In Croatia, the accent is the Dalmatians and, you know, continental. You can get, I think more people get beaten up because they're from Dalmatia. Or did get beaten up then because they were gay, you know. So it's this geographical queer is important and it defines it really. But it doesn't mean that it's erased once it's presented somewhere else. I think it even is emphasized somehow. And what to me is important, and this was important for Croatia and now for the festival in New York, is to show that, to show those different perspectives that you can come at towards queer. So it's very important. For example, we work with hijras from India. So it's like the untouchable class.
Uh-huh.
So that's an incredible issue that it's interesting to look through the queer perspective also. And it works in the festival. Because it just, and it's kind of abstract. This, when you put so many shows from so many countries or places together under the umbrella of a queer festival, with this whole definition of queer of norms and anything out of the norm, then suddenly it all makes sense. And for the audience, it just enables people, I think, to see through the basic sexuality issues. And that, I think, was the key difference between the Queer Zagreb Festival and all the other queer festivals in the world. Mm-hmm. That was the the brilliant difference. Mm-hmm. Because the usually queer festivals, now it's changed, but those that were in existence then have been just through
sexuality
and were very local. Mm-hmm. And that sexuality was very uniformed. Also gay mm-hmm. or lesbian or trans, but uniformed in a way of perspective. So they all told a different story, even if it was a same story, even if it was an international festival. So it was a very often westernized, you know, spoken word, almost kind of therapeutic theater or dance.
Confessional.
Confessional, yeah, all those things.
Autobiographical.
Yeah, the usual. Yeah. It was all the same. So it didn't matter if it was from L.A., London or Berlin. It was the same deal. Mm-hmm. And that then makes a queer very monochrome, which it is not.
So gay art or LGBT art is not necessarily queer art
no.
for you?
So I'm not interested in gay poetry because it's gay. I always call it lesbian pottery. People get offended sometimes, and I use it always as a provoke thing, you know, in panels, because I just like the gay poetry and gay and lesbian pottery, how it sounds together. But that's not necessarily what art is. It's often, unfortunately, therapeutic, or it's just a crafty thing. You know, the problem with it, it's not that it's connected to because it's gay or lesbian. It's a folksy in a way. And I, you know, just like I would not be interested in, you know, pottery from a certain region from Korea. It would be the same thing.
So you think it's too embedded in a community?
I think so. And then it becomes too incestual and becomes too local or too closed, mm-hmm. and it can still be beautiful, but it doesn't speak beyond that place or that area or that experience, because it's just identity-based art. And that is something that, as a curator, I'm not interested. I can see the value of it for people to build their identity, mm-hmm. but this kind of autobiographical or identity-based art is not, for me, interesting. Now, this is the offend where people can get offended, because it's we fought so much to be able to express ourselves as a community. And the thing is that if we move this idea that it's done by gay people or by lesbians, and then suddenly it's what it is, if you move that, if you say, okay, then this is done by, I don't know, Croatians or by Italians, you know, this is also silly to call it. In that sense, the identity-based art, if somebody does Italian dance because it's Italian, it is also not interesting. This kind of adjective before whatever art form it is, we should get rid of that. So for me, the queer art does not depend on the sexuality of the person who does it. Mm-hmm. It is not identity-based art, not only because of that. Queer art is, for me, something that transgresses the art form and the content. It's the different way you talk about it. So, in terms of, for example, contemporary dance, it's maybe somebody that creates a different language of movement on stage, or undermines the whole idea of movement, that you need movement. For example, in Croatia, there is this choreographer that we work with a lot, Bruno Isaković. He did this performance called Denuded. It's a solo piece. And what he does, it's for me very a queer piece. It's a very personal, intimate piece, and also for the audience. It toured all over the world. And what he does there, he just changes the way his body is present on stage, through creating tension and relaxation in the body with breathing. It's an incredible idea, very, very simple, and it works, and it's queer in itself. So he doesn't do anything but breathe and slow, you know, minimal movements mm-hmm. on stage.
You also have programmed Jérôme Bell
yeah.
for years, quite regularly, mm. and he would not at all be considered a queer artist.
Yeah, that's true. But his work is very queer. I mean, we were only able to program smaller of his pieces because of the budget. But he has this huge piece called The Show Must Go On with a cast of, I don't know, 10 or 15 people. And the only thing they do on stage, it's a brilliant, brilliant piece, is they listen to songs, popular songs, and they do the literal thing in the song. So, for example, I don't know, Yellow Submarine, so, you know, they all go down in the theater proscenium and it's all yellow. Or La Vie en Rose, the whole theater becomes pink.
Killing Me Softly, They Slowly Die.
You know, it's this, and it's also a queer piece, because you can have there, you know, there are some moments in the piece where there's, you know, songs where you connect with the audience or something, and you know, that's actually one of my boyfriends was a guy from the stage. He connected with me on the while he was on stage, you know, singing kind of that song, and it was just, you know, the words were, I don't know, I Stare in Your Eyes. And we stared at each other for 5 minutes during that song, and that was a queer moment in that piece, you know, that was not expected. But it's something, what I want to say is that Jérôme Bell in that piece kind of undermined dance. So it's a dance piece, but there's no dance in it, you know, except maybe with Tina Turner, Tiny Dance, whatever it's called, Private Dancer, the song, if that's in it or something. But it's what I'm trying to say is that he's playing with form of the expectation of dance. And I think this is interesting when you go to the theater and you see something completely unexpected and you come with some ideas of it, because that plays with the same notion of stereotypical ideas about sexuality. When you talk to somebody and they have already a notion about you, because, okay, that person is gay, I know everything about you. So it's like this, you go to the theater, I'm going to see dance, I know what I'm going to see. So when you go somewhere and something completely turns you upside down, that can be more queer than gay poetry and lesbian pottery.
Is this what you refer to when you talk about the difference between iconic and indexical?
Yeah.
So you use C.S. Pierce's categories.
Yeah, it's quite
semiotic categories of sign, and iconic is basically the same thing, just smaller.
Yeah.
That's an icon. Whereas indexical means that it points to.
Points towards. Yeah. So it's like a
it's
trace.
It's metonymical to some extent.
So for me, it's yeah, that's the basics. It's a very simple concept. Obviously, it's like the basic idea, but this is. What for me defines, not only with queer art, but that's what for me is interesting in art in general, you know, this kind of allusion.
There's been a lot of queer art that has appeared in Australia in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, which I think is very interesting, but it's very different. It's very different from the sort of work that Queer Festival has programmed and Eurocas did before that, and I think it's very narrative. It's very based in narrative, in character, in script. I think the work that you have kind of educated me in and my generation actually is in many ways quite specific. It's very, it's performance. It has no narrative. It has no character. It has no script. It's very much based on presence on stage. It's very much based on kind of transgressing the body in various ways, the body of the audience, the body of the performer, violating it sometimes not. And I think when I started seeing these works appear here, which I'm not going to really necessarily describe because you wouldn't know them, I felt very confused by that. You know, I felt like I had a prejudice about what queer art should be, that I didn't know that I had. That for something to be queer, for art, for performance to be queer, it couldn't have character. It couldn't have a situation. It couldn't have dialogue. You know, it couldn't represent, it couldn't be representational, because that fundamentally is,
I understand you. I think it can be, of course, but it's just not interesting. You know, like, I wouldn't go to see a classical theater piece in the National Theater because I don't find it interesting. Mm-hmm. It's just that. It's still a theater piece. It's still great for some people. But it's not for me, as a curator then, and as a viewer, something that I would necessarily appreciate in the theater. This kind of narrative. I want something else, and it doesn't speak to me like that. So, yes, queer work can be very traditional, very, you know, narrative-based, and most of it is. And that's why to create a program of the festival, I have to, you know, travel many, many places and expand this idea of what queer is, and then create a festival that maybe it becomes more obvious that something could be queer within that framework, but not necessarily some that show about from Sharon Bell that I mentioned. If it played anywhere else, not many people would even think about reading it queer, or would even think, okay, he's doing something, you know, with it that could be read through that perspective. But I've seen now that I've been in Australia for a month, I met many artists, and I saw some work and some queer work, and it wasn't so great. I saw this piece by James Wellsby. It's work about AIDS, HIV and AIDS, and it's apparently done after, I mean, it was a long research that James did and talked to many people and did in collaboration with different artists, I think, through the process. But I found the piece to be exactly that, very narrative, very almost scared of its subject, and it didn't use irony where I thought it should in the piece, and it just didn't lift off somehow. And the problem there was the narrative of it. Mm-hmm. If it just went away from that, it could work. I mean, the narrative of the piece was, it's really, really strange, but it's very obvious narrative. Yes, AIDS is a terrible disease, and it killed many people. And we want to fight it. That was the, it's, you don't need a piece for that. you, it doesn't give you, you don't walk away with another idea about it. You don't even walk away touched about the tragic history of AIDS. You just come in with that knowledge that any sane person would have before, and you walk away with absolutely the same idea that you walked in. You're just a little bit maybe bored because you spent 1 hour, you know, digesting that same notion. I'm being now very cruel almost here, but I, you know, I talked to James about it, and I think the problem was him as a younger person talking about a whole other generation that was affected with the disease, and many people have died, of course, that maybe he was just afraid to put his own, any other comment or thing.
Maybe he was too respectful.
Yes, yes, and that is always then a problem, you know, then it's, you know, then that's not the piece that you're ready to do. If you have too much respect for something, not to to change it or to bring your own experience. Everybody has experience with HIV, even if it's if you're not directly affected. But what I want to say is that what was great about that piece, at least, I just read somewhere more than 5,000 people have seen it, and people are more talking about HIV and AIDS more, which strangely came off the radar for a lot of young kids. And I know for myself, now that I've been here, I've been asked so many times to fuck bareback that I cannot believe.
How long have you been here?
1 month. Yes, it works very quickly, don't worry. But it's really strange that people are doing that. I have no problem you know, with any kind of sexuality or behavior. But it's just this idea that they're still worried about it. They would still say, are you negative? Mm-hmm. And what do you say? Yes, I am. Trust me. You know what I mean? Like, it's really strange. Then at least say, okay, well, I don't care. Yeah, but this is strange. So it shows to me that either people have no idea about it, or they think now it's not a deadly disease anymore. But it's true. It's not. It's a chronic disease. It's maybe even easier to be handled than diabetes on a daily base, how it affects your quality of life. Mm-hmm. But it's still a very serious illness that disrupts your life on a daily basis. And it shouldn't be forgotten, especially not because especially for young for young kids. So in that sense, this show Hex was an important piece. Mm-hmm. But for any artistic way, I don't think it was.
Just wanted to quickly mention, we both saw Kingdom by Ballet Lab, which I actually really enjoyed. But I kept thinking, oh yeah, as one who's not going to like this, because this is not queer, this is gay. This is fundamentally a gay show.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't like it. And it's strange for me to say it now, not only because they're all my friends, but I gave them a residency for research for that piece in Croatia. So they were there for 3 weeks last year. But no, I did not enjoy the piece because there were elements of it that I thought, I didn't think it went far enough in playing with this idea of kingdom or whatever they wanted to create. So I didn't think they went far enough in that. And again, it became almost, I don't even know how to say it in English, self-referential or self-important. And that's where I lost
it. Where did it go and where did you want it to go?
How it looks now, it's almost like it stopped in the middle of mocking itself. But it should have gone further. In the end, it took itself seriously, but it shouldn't have, the piece itself. Because when it becomes so camp and so, expressive or so silly in a way, then you can't really not make it as silly as possible or as camp as possible. Or you can't be taking it as holier than thou in a way. And I think maybe that's not, it's the even the energy within the between the performers. So I don't know, it's very strange now to say, but I think Philip himself almost doesn't fit in the piece, because he was a bit too himself there. So that's what actually kept it real in all the surrealism of the piece, and that bothered me as a viewer.
The conversation that we had about the piece, about other pieces, really got me thinking. It kind of hinges on precisely something to do with Kingdom, where I was reading it as an essay, as fundamentally a very, very intellectual set of questions. Like it could have been a column in a newspaper,
right.
You know, and was not at all about form, was not at all about dance, but was very much about the notion of the gay community and the male gay community quite specifically, not lesbian, not queer, not gender, you know, the role of freedom in it, the role of excess and sort of orgiastic kind of sexual excess, and what is it ultimately for, and, you know, is it all just kind of, are we, not me, is there an actual emancipatory potential in all of this sexual kind of freedom and also freedom from established gender and family norms, or is it all just extremely self-indulgent and immature? And I was really having a conversation with the piece, sort of thinking, yes, I wonder, you know, my friend who lives in such and such way and my other friend who lives in such and such way, are they happy? I don't know, you know. And I find that there is something really quite interesting in moving away within the LGBT community, moving away from these like very basic questions of like, let's not get beaten up, you know, let's be allowed to get married, and really kind of questions of lifestyle and happiness and living your life in a certain way that is not 100% political. And I was then thinking about the kind of, you know, when people say to you, it's so nice to see a gay movie where nobody dies. You know, it's nice to see queer people just living their life. I've been thinking about the emancipatory potential of that particular, of the queer normality, you know, as which is maybe subversive precisely because it's queer and normal at the same time, and it's not someone, you know, taking flags out of their genitals.
Yeah, no, of course, and I'm the first. I think now almost the most radical thing is to be emotional. You know, and there is a festival I would like to do about it, to be honest. And there's another festival that I'd like to do with couples artists. I mean, artists who are also working together and living together as couples. And I'm the first one always to complain, especially with performance art, that a lot of people are just going immediately to the aesthetic of ugly and aesthetic of pain. and especially younger artists, because they feel that's the most direct hit they can do to inflict, you know, to shock the audience somehow. And I think really, especially with the queer thing now, it's with everything how it works, unfortunately, it seems like emotion is the radical thing. It's the feeling you are not allowed to. It's a feeling you are not allowed to express almost anymore within.
Well, it feels to me that a lot of queer art and then queer community gets focused on certain emotions like pride, defiance, anger, which are very simple emotions.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, they're simple emotions.
Mm. I mean, I think I don't know, but I mean, I don't know about the value of emotion, but the characterization of emotion. But what I think about this normalization, what you're saying, there is also a thing that what's happening now with the queer, you know, with legislation and everything, it's getting very normalized, and that I think is the problem. In the bigger scale, because I think now a gay couple with kids, a married gay couple with kids, has less connection to a druggy 23-year-old who fucks in a park, a kid who fucks in a park, than to his than to the neighbor's straight couple with kids. And that connect that has been a disconnection here. So in that sense, I think the what is being normalized is the very heteronormative almost version of gayness. So I think in that sense, it's important to radicalize again, maybe the thing. Doesn't mean, you know, people have to die in movies or something, but I think we need to resexualize our community in a way, or at least, you know, what I'm saying is that it's almost like half of us got out and got saved by the society because we accepted what they want us to be, and half of us are condemned then judged by
forever.
Everybody, you know, even those that went over the fence, over the white fence.
And where is the middle? Because, you know, when the sort of art that we have kind of built as a canon of queer art, and, you know, pulling flags out of genitals, sort of as a very simple picture there, as much as it issues representation, it actually does have a representational function in the wider society of sort of the same way in which if you call someone homosexual, you're emphasizing the sexual aspect of their life. Here we're sort of emphasizing the strange, the bodily, the transgressive, and so on, at the expense of the time when, you know, as a gay person, you're just doing the dishes, which also happens, you know, or you're just
not in my house. I never do the dishes. kidding, but no, it's absolutely true. But it's I think the body for us, I mean, body in performance art is the medium, so it's not only. But the queer body and queering the body and showing that body, it's generationally important. And it's important to, you know, take the flags out of the pussy in public. It's important to, you know, like a Croatian artist, Vlasta Delimar, to walk naked in the streets. It's important. So it's important to do it every year, every day. It's important to change, you know, because it's always there. It's liberating somehow. It's important to accept the body. It's important to see the body and to see the other body and to see dancers who are fat, dancers who are not, you know, the image of dance that we always have. It is important to change that that thing, and that liberates them. Because if you only see beautiful bodies on stage, of course you never feel adequate for anything else. That's our Cosmopolitan magazine for us poor souls that go to the theater. That's where we get our insecurities, I suppose. And that's why I like to put non-normative bodies on stage for myself.
A friend of mine referred to it as what did he call it? The capitalist queer aesthetic.
What?
This sort of you call something queer, you open the doors, and a whole bunch of beautiful, tanned, you know, rich gay men come through with their art.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, could be.
And then we get, you know, American sitcoms. We get, what's it called?
But that's okay. I'm not.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with America. You know, I think it did. You know, if you talk, I don't know, which I guess everyone, but Will and Grace and all this, I think that was very important for a lot of people. You know, to be honest, I'd rather be pinked washed than stoned to death. You know, it's simple as that. And I, you know, I accept that. But maybe just me. You know, I'm more of a glossy faggot in that sense.
Our guest today was Zvonimir Dobrović, the founder of Queer Festival in New York and Zagreb. This episode of Audio Stage was produced by Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. You can find us on iTunes and on our website, audiostage.guerrillasemiotics.com. So stay tuned as we continue to discuss what queer means for us and for theatre.